notice. The tendency hasn't changed, just the substance. I'm going to put the steps down here for me and a clock. My name's Adele. I'm very gratefully clean and sober. And I am so grateful to be here as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to be free from the enslavement of alcoholism. That's how addiction is described, an enslavement to a substance or behavior. And I was enslaved many years after I got sober. And I'm so grateful to be free. Thank you so much, Glenn and Christine, for hosting us. And we've been treated so beautifully by everybody. Thank you, John, for taking us up to the Springs Hotel. How glorious that was. And my husband, whom I absolutely adore. I'm so glad you got to hear him last night. I'm so lucky to be with him. This is our 21st year. And I love him more today than I ever have. And that's what's possible. You know, I hope that we embody that love and that our being together speaks so loudly that you don't hear a word we're saying. I took a walk this morning in this beautiful community. We've had just such a wonderful time. And thank you, Charlene and Chris, for bringing to the attention of the committee about us. We're so grateful to be here. And they are members of Sedona, where we live. They are part of our community. They come down about once a year or so. And we're so grateful to have them. If you're in Sedona, I have a lot of home groups. 7:30 in the morning upon awakening, we meditate in that group and share. The Wednesday women's group at the Unity Church, and Jay and I attend on Saturday, 8 a.m. at Stutz Bearcat. You're so welcome, and we hope you contact us when you're coming through. It's a place as beautiful as here. I was walking this morning trying to get settled before here, and I came, you know, walking down the street, and I saw this big mountain, so glorious. And I noticed there was something that was not happening in the mountain. Do you know what that was? It wasn't thinking. At all. It was just being. It wasn't running around trying to fix anything. It wasn't trying to go to Los Angeles to heal people. It wasn't trying to take anyone's inventory. It didn't wish it was a river. It was just being. And the whole world comes to it. It was grounded in its source. In the glory of it brings people to its feet. And that is a lesson that I've had a really hard time learning. I ate to be with me, and I drank to be with you. And part of my story is that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not coming to recover from alcoholism. I was with someone from another program, and she was stalking someone. And so I came into the closing meeting of a roundup. There was about 4,000 people there. And I was very, very grateful that all of you had Alcoholics Anonymous, because it appeared that you needed it very much. But I was so struck by what was happening in there. And at the closing prayer, when everyone held hands, I was deeply, deeply moved. And I came back. And I knew that there was something there for me. I'm also a recovering bulimic, and I want to talk to that about that for just a moment because it's extremely important with regards to my recovery from alcoholism. Number one, I want to be a pig and not pay for it. As long as I look okay on the outside, then whatever's happening on the inside is okay. As long as I can hide it from you, then there's nothing really going on. That's number one. Secondly, is both are going to kill me, and I need to address them. I need to go where I can get recovery from that addiction as well. I have a sponsor in that program. I've attended in that program, and I can't. I need to hear specific information from people who do what I do in order to recover. The other thing is I have 25 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is June 28th, 1989. And I have about 19 and a half years in Overeaters Anonymous of abstinence. And I got abstinent and sober on the same day, which means I relapsed in Overeaters Anonymous while I was sober. And what happened was I was so ashamed about that I came into meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and I lied by omission. If you have a compulsion, if you have something going on that you're hiding, every time you walk into, and by my favorite form of dishonesty is by omission. And you know what? There's a funny thing about that. It's lying. And so every time I walked into a room and I didn't talk about what I was hiding, I was lying to you. And the voice told me you are a liar and a cheat and a thief as I was sitting there looking good. And you know why it told me that? Because I was. I was doing all of those things. And that is a horrible way to live, and that is not being sober. And if you have something like that going on, you know, you may be thinking, well, food that has nothing to do with alcoholism. You know, it might be like porn all night or whatever it is for you. Or there's some lie. And what's happening is it's coming between you and your God and other people and your job and all those kinds of things. Please grab one of us and tell us. We might not have that problem, but we know someone who does. And even more important, we know someone who doesn't have to do that anymore. And you don't have to suffer like that, like I did for 3 years. So that's a really important part. I grew up in a really crazy family. I know that comes to a big shock to most of you. And thank you to all the speakers this weekend. I was very moved. I related very much. Larsine, I related so much to what you were talking about. I was that kid in the family. There was alcoholism. Let me describe what the house was like. Maybe about 1,300, 1,400 square feet. There were 9 kids. My mom had married someone with 7 children, and they had a child, and an alcoholic. His wife was in a mental institution, and she went to fix him. We had, in that tiny house, we raised Rottweilers and English Mastiffs. We had gerbils, we had parakeets, cats, we had peacocks in the basement, chickens. We were the family on the block that everyone talked about. But the crazy thing was, we were told how special and above everyone we were. When I grew up, it was like this. And I knew something was wrong. I had come into this family. I was kind of a really strange kid. I never wanted to fit in. I hear that all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. That idea made me nauseous. I wanted to stand above and apart. I wanted to be special. I wanted first place on the wall behind me, and that's how my office was when I got sober. They would be lined up, and you would look at them when you came in. I had to get an A plus for a C average. A plus so I was allowed to breathe. I did not want to fit in. And as a kid, I experienced the whole world as a personal assault. My senses were way, way overstimulated. I came out of the chute like that. Everything hurt. It was too bright. It was too loud. And I got dumped into this family with all this stuff going on. And I was, it was like Sarajevo every day. And so what I did was I retreated to my mind. I retreated completely into thought. I lived from above the nose up. That's it. I had no sense of body. I had no sense of anything. I went there to be safe. That's where I lived. That's like going to the ghetto to get a good night's sleep, you know? And so I lived completely out of touch with everything going on. I was not interested in what was happening. I was interested in what else was happening, you know, what else might be. I waited for someone to come and rescue me, and nobody came. When I was about 11, I realized nobody was coming. And that's when I retreated completely to my mind. I was a straight-A student. All of my stepbrothers and sisters were into drugs and alcohol. There was a lot of compulsive overeating, a lot of insanity in that house. And I was the good kid. It was the only slot that was left. I had my first drinks when I was about 13. My stepbrothers, who hated being around me, you know, there's nothing worse than the kid in the family who's getting straight A's, you know. They used to steal my report cards. They did everything to try to get me to shut up so I wouldn't get them in trouble. And they didn't want any part of me. But somehow they got, you know, talked into to taking me with them. And I had, as I recall, I had 11 beers and a bottle of Strawberry Hill, I think it was. I didn't have a shutoff valve. I just didn't have one. I still don't have one. You can see I always carry two drinks. Always. And what happened was I had a blackout. I was to have blackouts much through... Actually, I kind of had brownouts. That's when you come to in various points of the night. It's really bad. I wished I had just pure blackouts. But I you know, I ended up in a park faced, you know, with a boy. I was a really good kid. And in the car and on the floorboards, you know, throwing up, that kind of thing. And I had a couple other experiences like that where I blacked out. And I decided at that point that I was not going to drink until I graduated from high school. It never occurred to me to drink less. Never even went through my mind. I just knew that when I picked up alcohol, I could not control the outcome. And I had too much invested in being good. And so I went about doing that. I want to talk a minute about what was happening in that house, because I don't think that my environment caused me to be alcoholic. I have an abnormal response when I drink. A couple things happen. I flush, which means I get really hot and really red. That's something that happened more and more the more I drank. The other thing is I want more right now. I just want more. That's all I can think of. More, more, more. That's an abnormal reaction. And what I know about that is that, you know, I'm made like that. I don't even care about why. But what my family did set me up for was delusion. In my family, I knew things were very different than what was being reported in the house. And the way I experienced it was, the walls were pink. Whack, they're blue. No, the walls are pink. Whack, they're blue. A lot of violence, a lot of insistence that things that were not actually happening were, and things that were happening were not. So ultimately, I stopped saying the walls are pink. And then I stopped believing the walls are pink. So I am well set up for delusion. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was not in denial. The definitions, and it's very important for me. I find that I'm confused about things a lot. It's really helpful to look things up in the dictionary for me. I was college educated. I was a college administrator when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor told me to look up the words in the big book. And I explained to her. She was never interested in my explanations. That I was well educated, and she told me to look them up anyway. And so I did. And denial is that there is some fact, something that I'm saying that I'm denying is either false or true. The underlying implication is that I know the difference, right? A delusion is a persistent false belief about something inside or something I perceive to be outside that I deny with irrefutable evidence to the contrary. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous believing the lie. And so it took me several years to get up to denial. Now, that was a big leap forward. And so what I was set up very well for in my growing up was delusion. The thing about delusion is it's completely self-referential. That is, it's kind of like a dream. You know, if you're inside a dream, you only have the reference to the dream itself. You don't have any outside reference. So when I'm trying to tell someone or yell at them and they're in a delusion, it's kind of like if there's someone who is delusional in a hospital, let's say he believes there are snipers in the room. And you're in the room with him, and he sees, it's not as if he's making up the fact that there are snipers in there in the way we think making up. He sees them as if they're real, and they're shooting at him. And I'm going to shake him and say, there are no snipers. Do you think that's going to be helpful? No, it's not. So there has to be some kind of a crack in the delusion in order for help to come into him, right? Has anyone ever seen A Beautiful Mind? If you haven't, I really urge you to rent that. And if you have, to see it again and think of it in terms of alcoholism. There's a point at which the main character, the scientist, he's driving down the street. He's already been in a mental hospital, and he sees a whole set of events that aren't happening, especially, in particular, his college roommate, which we don't find out until halfway through the movie, only exists in his mind, and a little girl. And he's driving in the rain, and he realizes suddenly that the little girl has never grown up. And that's the moment in which help can come through. And even though he sees that in the future, what does he do? He ignores it. He doesn't engage with the false belief, even though it's present to him, because he knows that it's not real. That doesn't mean it stops appearing to him. That means he knows it's not real. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll just tell you that I started drinking again when I went to college. I never experience what I hear in, you know, the, people talk about having fun, and I looked like I was having fun. You know, I was very theatrical. I wore opera. I know you can't believe that. I wore opera gloves and, you know, had all kinds of colors of hair. I was screaming, you know, that I was different and then trying to convince you of how smart I was. I was just confused. And I drank to quiet down this head. It was just like, shh, that's all I wanted. You know, you have that drink and you go, that's what I wanted. I wanted to rest. I believe that everything we do in the material world, everything we look for, everything we seek, everything we try to get and grab sober to, is for the purpose of resting. If I follow it down the line, I want that really nice car. I want to, why do I want the car? Why do I want the job? So people will notice me and they'll tell, you know, they'll tell me I'm okay and I'll feel okay about myself. Why do I want that? So I can rest. And you know, the funny thing is that rest is our very nature. That's who we are. Can you feel it right here, right now? Wow. That's so cool. The steps are designed to clean us out so we can experience what we really are, which is rest. And the way I went about before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, getting to the point where I could rest, was the most unrestful thing in the world. The place I went to feel safety and security and peace was a madhouse. I was the torturer of myself and looking for peace. It was, you know, I was so confused. I was just so confused. I got sober at 30. And what I was doing, I because I flushed when I drank, I had to take my clothes off a lot. Wearing lingerie in public became very popular, but in 1976, I assure you, it was not. So, I, you know, at the end of my drinking, I couldn't go out anymore because, you know, when you're 21, it's cute. When you're 30, it really stops being cute. I wasn't cute anymore. And I was at home doing exactly what I saw growing up. I was drinking a box of wine. You know, we came from wine connoisseurs. That's what my stepdad always, he had wine collections. But I'll tell you, at night, the Gallo Vin Rosé got opened and the lid screwed off. You know, even today, I have a really hard time with lids. Yeah, you just open it. So I was sitting at home with that box of wine. And it had become, I was in the progressive stages of alcoholism and I didn't know it. It started tasting like rubbing alcohol to me. And I was in a state of delusion. So I had told myself that that what I was experiencing was normal. I didn't go to sleep, I passed out. But I just needed it to help me go to sleep. I didn't drink in the morning if it went in a blender, or I was still drinking the night before, or it went into something that looked like a breakfast drink, you know? I drank really sweet alcohol. I told everyone for several years I didn't drink vodka. I just put it in all the sweet alcohols to cut the sweet. You know, I was absolutely delusional. And my sponsor was very wonderful. She said, Adele, you know, it might be that some other people can stay in program and not work the steps, but you're far too sick. I do want to tell you that I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous and I did not get a sponsor for the first 6 months. And the reason I didn't was because I was too frightened to ask for help. I could help you, but I came in here dying of compulsive competency. I came in with, I wore all black, I had red lipstick on, and high heels. I'm 6 feet tall on the natch, and I had that do not speak to me under any circumstances. Look on my face, I look like I was here for years. People were asking me directions, but they weren't introducing themselves. And I wondered why you weren't talking to me. You know, get away from me and please, where are you going? You know, that kind of thing. So I look for the girls with their lipstick on straight. Because I know that they're going to fall apart sometime. And that's going to be the moment when they start getting well. And I want to be there when that happens, you know. Because I understand them. I understand them. So she had me start with step one. And she had me write out step one. I learned, at that time, I was using a computer, and I never handwrote anything. And I informed my sponsor of that. And I was trying to, and she told me, Adele, when you type, it accesses the wrong side of the brain. When you write, it accesses your emotional, and it's a great lie detector. You can type a lie in a heartbeat. It's hard, much harder to write it. And so I have never written inventory with anything but a pen and paper. And she had me write down how my drinking had affected the people, my other people that I knew, my friends, my family, my job, my education, my relationship with myself, and my relationship with the power greater than myself. And I was really grateful for that because I got to realize, make real what had happened to me. And I was able to discern whether, I love the word discern. The word discern means that I look and see whether my behavior and actions brought about the effect that I had desired when doing them. Isn't that a great definition? I love that. My sponsor gave that to me. And I got to see whether or not that was true in my drinking. And I got to see the delusion that it was true because it was in black and white before me. And that was the chink. You know what I mean? And I started, and information started coming in. I really did not know if I was alcoholic for a long time. Everyone I knew drank like I did. I grew up in that environment, and I didn't know the difference. And so that was, you know, wonderful. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had a really hard time with that on two levels. Number one, the thing about insanity. I had come from insanity in my family. And I was too afraid to even admit that might be possible. Because if it was possible, then I might go crazy like my father did. He was diagnosed as schizophrenic and bipolar, homicidal. He drank himself to death in San Diego, and they found him dead weeks later. I found out about that when I got sober. And my mom was very erratic. And so I was too afraid to admit that. The other part of that was that I really fought about whether or not I believed in a higher power. I mean, I just couldn't sleep at night. Any of you have the problem of thinking so much that your head hurts? And I would like to propose to you that absolutely nobody comes into Alcoholics Anonymous an agnostic or an atheist. Nobody. Here's the definition I love of a God or a higher power. Number one, I have to ask myself, what do I worship? That is, what do I devote my attention and time to? And secondly, what do I turn to when I'm afraid? Bingo. There's my God. Now, it's a false sense of God, but nevertheless, it's the one I have. We are not asking anyone to believe in a higher power. We're asking you to believe, to try a different higher power. The ones I were using were alcohol and drugs and men and food and work. Work was horrible. It's the only addiction that the sicker you get, the more applause you get. And I was really sick with that one. I've never been asked to give in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're always giving. Always. We can't help it. What we are is what we give. What we're being is what we give. Thank you. If I'm being judgmental, then I give it to you. If I'm being frightened, I give it to you. I just spew my fear all over you and say that I'm trying to be helpful. What I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous is to give something different. And so I was told that I could try these 12 steps. And I turned myself over to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a power greater than myself and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the steps. And it says, it doesn't say that we'll come to figure out a different kind of a God, although I tried to do that. It said we'll have the experience of a spiritual experience by working the steps. This is not a logical program. I have really good news for those of you who don't like that part of it. This is not there's no spiritual part of this program. It's all spiritual. All of it. We are not human beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. If we were really human beings, then the principles of the world would work on us. It would work to solve our alcoholism. I was a business professor, and economics was the allocation of scarce resources. That is a material definition. It's a principle in this material sense of the world that we have, right? How's that working for the world? In God, it's infinite. I don't have to give up something. We don't have to have limited things, you know, resources in this room, and you're going to take a little piece of it, and you're going to take a little piece of it, and God, I better get more than you do. We have access to infinite fulfillment for each one of us. It does not take away from you if I have infinite fulfillment, because it's infinite, right? If I were simply a human being, then all of those things would work. But we have a set of spiritual principles, because our problem is of a spiritual nature. And that's what works. That's really, really cool to know. I'm looking down at the steps. I'm not reading my notes. It helps me to have guidelines, and it helps me to remember that this is what we're doing here. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I don't understand what God is, and I don't want to. It's not in... God can't be found in the intellect. How could it be? The intellect is finite by definition. God is infinite. This power is infinite. Going to my intellect to try to describe or define God is like going to the hardware store for bananas. It ain't there. I looked for years there and couldn't find it, but it's not there. So I can rest and stop looking in this mind, these thoughts for a sense of God. I can relax and feel that. You know, and I'll talk about the 11th step, which has been extraordinarily essential in my recovery. In step three, we make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. What was really helpful for me to learn, and it took a lot of years working the steps, and I do want to say that I've done the steps completely many times. Now, for the last probably 20 years, since I've been with Jay, actually, I do the steps when they're indicated. I've worked with a lot of people. I didn't mention at 9 months sober, I was sponsoring 11 people. I told you I was suffering from compulsive competency. And so doing was not a problem for me. Being was a whole other thing. But what I do the full steps every 5 years with the group. Usually, whomever I'm sponsoring will go together, and I go through as an equal. I do the steps fully. We usually do it over about 18 weeks on whatever's kicking my butt at the time. I do not do it on alcohol. It's essential to do it in the first inventory, but I haven't had a drink for a long time. What is kicking my butt is something related to my thinking. Last time I did it on the insistence and belief that I was right about anything. That was illuminating. I heard people talking about sides of the story this weekend, and I realized as I was sitting there that we believe there's a story, and then I have a side over here, and then you have a side over there, as if this story is an entity that exists without us. It's not. There's no story without us. There's nothing but an appearance of something. That's it. We are the ones with the story. And that's really helpful for me to know, because I've already told you how confused I've been. On step three, I thought I was turning my will and my life over to the care of God, and that it was an entity that belonged to me, and therefore I was going to turn it over to something. You know, my God often looked like Santa Claus, sometimes had a cape. And what I've realized is that it's not mine. I don't actually have to. And for me, turning my will and life over is really about control. You know, I want to control my environment. I want to control everything. I told you I grew up in a very violent and insane kind of house. I just wanted to be safe. So I'm going to control my environment so that I have a sense of safety. And step three is about releasing that. But I thought I actually had to give up control. It was very helpful for me to realize I never had it. I never had a life of my own. Do I beat my heart? Grow my hair? Do I do any of that? Do I animate myself? Absolutely not. So what I have to actually turn over is the idea that I do. Isn't that cool? I mean, it's so much easier to release an idea than it is to release an entity that I actually believe I have. The more I realize that, the easier step three is. And I get confused still. But so what is it that I really want to do in sobriety? Stop trying to fix things out here. Turn my attention to being aware of the presence of God, being aware that it is not my will in my life. lift or increase the light in the room, in my consciousness. In this room, they probably have dimmers, right? Guess what? With us, the dimmers are on us. I want to increase the light of my awareness, not fix something out here, because you know what? You're not broken, and neither is anything else. And what I have to do is get out of the darkness of thinking it is. So my whole sobriety is very different than it was in the beginning. And thank goodness. If I, you know, doing this, I hear people say that I'm doing the same things I've always done. And yes, to some degree that's true. I go to meetings, I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't touch the first drink, etc. But if I'm doing the same things that I did when I got sober, I'm in trouble. Hopefully I've grown along spiritual lines. I can't do the same. I can't get away with that kind of stuff anymore. You know? When I made a searching and fearless moral inventory, I had a hard time getting started on that. What I want to say is today I do it a little bit different. The fourth step is about our resentments. I hear people also say that my part in it. What was my part? I have no part in... I don't have a part in my resentment. I have 100% of it. It means, the word resent means to re-feel. How can you re-feel or re-feel anything that I'm experiencing? The resentment is 100% mine. And if someone is feeling for you, God help you. I looked up the word resentment again a couple days ago, and I also saw from the Latin etymology or history of the word, it also means sense. So I'm going to re-sense something. So I have a perception of something that's happened in the past. It's a misperception. And every time something reminds me of it, then I re-feel that original experience. And guess what? Your body does not know whether it's happening now or happening then. You go through the same physiological response every time you think about that. In my fourth step, I could tell you a lot, I have stories that have actually been told this weekend. But I want to tell you about one in particular. I had two resentments on my fourth step that I couldn't get freed of. One was from my father. When I was about 6 weeks old, I was tortured and raped, and just unspeakable things had happened with my father. And I was hurt. I was physically hurt. It caused a lot of problems in my life. I've had many, many surgeries. I've had 18 major surgeries sober. Probably somewhere under 50 that were outpatient. And a lot of those, the initial ones and ones that came after, were related to that. And I could not get free from that. I knew that maybe I would stay sober. Maybe I would be okay. But there was something broken in me, something dirty that I could not get cleaned. I tried absolutely everything. You know, I was in groups. I did a lot of therapy. I have not just come to program. I've done a lot of work. I had to. I never suffered more than when I got sober. Because there was nothing left. What I did was, I was willing to be free of that resentment. I just remained willing. And I just couldn't get free. When I was 16 years sober, 16 years of depression, 16 years of chronic illness, 16 years of feeling broken and dirty, I would be with my husband, whom I loved, and I would want to punch him during sex. And how could I forgive something like that? How could I ever see that I had some piece of that that was my doing? I had a near-death experience at 16. I had fallen and broken my hip, and I was in the hospital. And when I got home, it completely changed my life. When I got home, my husband was gone, and I was in the bathroom. I was so weak, I probably weighed about 100 pounds. I'm 6 feet tall. I was too weak even to lift myself. But I had a profound experience in which I knew I was already well. And shortly after that, maybe about a month after that, I was in the bathroom and I went to reach for the faucet. And the thought came into my mind from nowhere, seemingly, he would never hurt his baby girl. And I knew it was true. I knew it was true. And all of a sudden, what went through my mind was everything I had done in my life to hurt other people. I had done things that weren't what he did, but I had done things that really injured other people. And I never, ever did it to them. They were just there. And I knew that he did not do it to me, that I was just there, that he was looking for rest. He was looking for peace. And he was very confused as to its source. And I got free. I got free of something that I absolutely knew I could never get free of. And it happened. I'll tell you today that I have lived through amazing, amazing healings. And absolutely nothing is impossible in God's world. Step 6 and 7. About step 5. I did not have the relief that people experience. I heard David talk about that this weekend. I wanted to shoot my sponsor or move after it. I didn't. I was absolutely aware that I had been in public for 30 years acting the way I did. And it was the first time I had any self-awareness of that. And it was just hideous. And my sponsor put me right through to step 8 and 9. I went over 6 and 7 then, and they're really important. I want to go back to them. We don't have to worry about our defects of character getting in contact with them. They get in contact with us. And what happened over the years is I have come to understand that what I did in 6 and 7, which is, number one, I had to stop calling it a defect of character. There's no problem with it, but language really affected me. And what I realize now is a coping mechanism. It's a character defense. We're defending a sense of self that's false. And for me, it's an effect of an underlying belief that's false. And so what I had to do, and I've worked really hard on 6 and 7, particularly in the last years, is I had to do a lot of work with myself, because there were aspects to my awareness that are very, very young. And in fact, in the 4th step, I have another column, a 5th column that I ask people to write. And that is, what does this remind you of? Whatever it is, because it all goes back to that young part. And these parts to me were young, and I didn't like them. I had shoved them in a closet and closed the door. Work the steps, just work the steps. That's what I would say to myself. And I wasn't addressing this frightened part of myself that I had ignored. I didn't want to deal with it. And do you know something? It dealt with me. That's the reaction that I'm giving that I don't want to give. I like to think of it as putting a bridle on a bucking horse. It works for a while till you let go. I was praying for God, that, remember, it's the one in the cape, to come down and remove the defective character. And sometimes it would work in the moment, but it would never sustain itself. And why? Because I had an underlying belief that wasn't addressed. And what I had to do is I had to start dialoguing. In the morning, I would write to this part of myself, and I would say, "Sweetheart, how are you this morning? Why do you hurt?" I had a lot of physical stuff, and that's really what gets my attention today. If I'm hurting physically today, all I have to ask myself is, what am I doing that's not okay with me regardless of my judgment, or what am I not doing that's not okay with me regardless of my judgment? And every single time I'll get to the root of why I'm feeling bad emotionally or physically. And I had to start writing, "Sweetheart, what do you hurt today? I hate you, I hate you, I hate you, I hate you," is what I got back. And what I was doing was I was making myself do things that were not okay with me, that were not okay with what my purpose is in this life, because I had an idea of what good Adele was supposed to look like. And you know where I got that? I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no good Adele before that. And I came in here and I started doing a lot of things and making a persona in Alcoholics Anonymous that it was exhausting to keep up. Really, really hard. I think it was harder to be good Adele than bad Adele. And bad Adele was exhausting. And so what I had to do is really listen and respond. I don't want to do this. And I had to start listening and responding, regardless of my judgment. And it took about 2 years. You know, if you have a little kid and you abandon the kid, and then you go back once every 6 months, and you say, "Oh, I'm so glad to see you. You want to come?" You think that child's going to trust you? Absolutely not. It took day after day showing up for myself in that way. And do you know what I was doing? I was bringing God to that part of me. Because the only God of my experience is the one I'm conscious of. And that takes place right there. There isn't a God outside of myself. Because I can't be conscious of that. My whole consciousness resides here. I'm pointing here. It doesn't actually reside there. But you got the point. And so I had to bring the grace of gentleness and understanding and love to myself. I was unable to do that without the second half of the 11th step. I'm going to go to that now, because that's been so incredible. The step 10 keeps us cleaned out so that we can have an experience of silence in which all answers come. Otherwise, it's just too noisy. When I tell you that I had a hard time with the 11th step, the second half of the 11th step, you can believe me. I had compulsive thought. They call it OCD. They call it attention deficit disorder. We just have undisciplined minds. We don't have alcoholic minds. We have childish minds. We have selfish minds. We have undisciplined minds. And so we let God, we get disciplined. We let God discipline us in exactly what's described in our 11th step in the big book. And it takes a lot of practice. If you think you're bad at the 11th step and that's why you're not doing it, join the crowd. We all suck at it. You know, and I was on 3 minutes a day for 11 years before I was able to do much more than that on a regular basis. I had such a hard time sitting still. I just did. There are many techniques to do that. I kept a pad of paper by me in the beginning, and I would write down, "Feed the cat." I mean, I would be sitting there, I'd be trying to meditate, "Feed the cat, feed the cat, feed the cat, feed the cat." so I would write down feed the cat, and then I could go back to the silence. You know, I've tried all kinds of pointers. They're all wonderful. One thing I do want to say is Jay and I have been meditating together. We've worked with hundreds of couples, and what we find is most people in Alcoholics Anonymous and in program have a spiritual life, but they don't have a shared one. It is amazing what happens if you meditate with your partner. If you don't have a partner, an animal works great. You know, when you can you imagine you're holding your cat or your dog and just sitting there, you're so happy this animal's all curled up. Are you ever wondering what it's thinking? No, God doesn't wonder what we're thinking. Just so glad we're there. You know, it's like about 4 years ago, 2000, well, it was December of 2010, January of 2011, I didn't want to live anymore. I had a wonderful life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a wonderful husband, and I had been in chronic debilitating pain for 21 years. I've had 8 strokes. I'm a miracle, huh? Open heart surgery, a couple brain surgeries. I've had a tumor larger than I was when I was born. I've had all kinds of just bizarre things happen. They finally diagnosed the illness and reported it to be genetic, incurable, progressive, and deadly. But it just takes you a piece at a time. And it was. I wore braces and high boots to walk across the floor because I couldn't walk without falling. If you hugged me, I would dislocate. At night, I had to sleep with pillows on both sides of me because my hips would dislocate at night. Have you ever had anything dislocated? It's extraordinarily painful. That would happen to me up to 3 times a day. I didn't want to live anymore. I had to wear lidocaine patches on the bottom of my feet to walk. And I was just done. And I told my husband, honey, I'm just done. I can't do this anymore. I had had a lot of surgeries, and I had kept the medication from those. And also, I had to get on medication and off medication and on medication and off medication many times. Thank you so much for Butch, who talked about that. If you have not had the experience of catastrophic illness or long-term awful chronic pain, please do not give anyone advice. It can be deadly. We don't give advice here. We give experience, strength, and hope. And people said some extraordinarily cruel things to me. And there was one thing, and so I had the means. I wasn't going to come back as a newcomer. No way. I said, baby, I got to go. But there was one thing I hadn't tried. God as everything. 100%. I hadn't tried that. See, I still had, and this was my experience. I was laying on a table at 21 years sober, getting one more exam for one more surgery. And I knew, I was listening to a spiritual teacher, and I had been doing intense spiritual work for a long time. And I absolutely knew there was no material sustained relief for me. There wasn't any. I had so many things go wrong. You know, I was like Exhibit A at Cedars-Sinai. I walked into a heart specialist's office, and he literally took me in front of 14 doctors from all over the world and showed me that there was someone still alive with this. And I was laying it in this machine, and I absolutely knew there was no solution. And it had to be spiritual. And I had had an experience where I was relieved. I was healed about 4 years earlier. And now this was happening again, and I couldn't believe it. And I was in the place where they call the jumping off point. J just like in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like with sobriety, just like with food, just like with a bunch of other stuff, but this was worse. But because I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous so long, I knew what to do. First of all, I was told that when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And that was my experience. A teacher came into my life. And I knew from you and from my program of AA that you do something entirely, that you turn your whole self over to it to the best of your ability. That's what I learned here, and I did that. And I went into what I would describe as spiritual boot camp for about 3 years. And I learned so much. First of all, my 3 minutes a day, which actually had 3 minutes a day is 1/470th of the day. Isn't that amazing? That's what I was promising to God, to be aware of the presence of God. Wherever my consciousness is parked, whatever I'm paying attention to, whatever fills up my thoughts is my experience. It's a principle. It doesn't cause my experience. Believing is seeing. It's exactly opposite from what we are told. Whatever I'm paying attention to is what my experience is. How is it that we come into Alcoholics Anonymous, we can't stop drinking, and then suddenly we stop drinking? That's impossible, because we get lifted into a state of awareness that we do not have to drink. And we don't know that before we come here, right? I was having the same experience with this illness. I was so consumed by it, consumed by the pain, consumed by the doctors. My focus was completely on it. And my belief that this was my lot in life. And so my teacher told me exactly what's that actually in our book, to completely turn my thoughts, myself, away from that and to the presence of God. Turn away from the problem and turn toward what it is that's truth. And so I went into meditation in a way I had never done before. When I realized, even 20 minutes I was doing at that point, that was 1/72nd of the day. I was spending 1/72nd of the day in surrendering my right to think, and 71/72nds of the day believing I had a right to think. And I realized what I was a liar. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because when I thought I was doing absolutely everything I could and I was giving everything to God, I was stuck. I can't get out of prison unless I know I'm not free. If I believe I'm free, I'm stuck. And what I had done in Alcoholics Anonymous is I did not have freedom. I had a bigger cell and more privileges. And so what I did was I said, okay, before I kill myself, isn't this what we say when we come into program? Before I kill myself, I'm going to try that. And I did. Amazing. I spent 3 years with that. Today I have absolutely no signs of that genetic, chronic, progressive illness. None. This isn't about me. This is not about me. This is about the principle. Wherever my awareness is, if I'm aware, I have my intellect, my mind is not my master. It's my servant. But it takes a great deal of discipline, because we're so used to it seeming more powerful than God. You know what I mean? We're so used to thinking what we want to think. Or even if we don't think we want to think, we're used to going there, man. It's like trying to eat one potato chip. And so I like like to think it like a puppy chewing furniture. You know, you leave the puppy and it goes off and it starts chewing different. You know, come here, sweetheart. That's what I used to say. Come here, sweetheart. Let's just sit with God now. Come here. And as soon as, you know, in a minute or two, my mind goes off again and I bring it back. Come here, sweetheart. Come on. Now, if I beat it, it's not going to stop chewing the furniture, is it? It's just going to chew the furniture and be afraid of me. So I have to keep bringing it back, keep bringing it back. It takes a great deal of discipline. I encourage you to explore your consciousness. Explore the silence. Go into that. Do it. There is so much for you to experience and realize. There is so much beauty and so much joy. It's unbelievable what's available. I spent 3 years looking at my beliefs. I was holding two beliefs. Well, many beliefs. They were in direct conflict. There is one power. That one is all. May you find him now. Not next Tuesday, by the way. May you find him now. And then talking about all the other powers in my life as if they were real. And believe me, if I believe they're real, that's my experience. And what I came to terms with was that I was extremely confused. And I got less confused. And today, my only desire today is to turn the lights up so I can experience the great reality that's talked about in our big book. And I'm so grateful to be here. And I want to thank all of you. Bless you.